This week's podcast is sponsored by Europe Talks, which is a brilliant event that you took part in last year, Dominic. So I'm just going to sit back, relax, and let you tell us all about it.
So lazy. But yes, Europe Talks is a really fun initiative where you get matched up with someone who has different opinions and who lives in a different country. And you ring them up and have a conversation about everything, really, about politics, climate change, whatever you want. And last year, they matched me up with a woman from Belgium, and we had a really nice conversation, although we realized that we actually agreed on most things. But I guess that's also nice.
Maybe that's because you managed to convince her, because you're so amazing and clever.
I don't think so.
After a year of social distancing and general insanity, we think this is a really nice effort to bring Europeans together to talk about the stuff that matters. So we will both be signing up, and we recommend that you do too.
Who knows, you might even get matched with me or Katie.
Thousands of Europeans are going to be taking part on December the 13th, and the more people who sign up, the more interesting conversations can take place between random people across the continent. Just search for Europe Talks or click on the link in the show notes.
Hi, Katie. Are you feeling a bit calmer this week?
I am. More importantly, what about you? I felt like you've been on the edge of a nervous breakdown for the last week or so. Have you reinstalled Twitter on your phone finally, now that you're not banned from checking it?
I actually let myself look at Twitter unashamedly the last few days, thinking maybe this is good for my mental health now that there is a bit of better news in the world.
Lots of us are very happy over here, even if our American friends got a bit carried away and there were lots of news reports about, like, the church bells ringing out across Europe in honour of Joe Biden and fireworks across London, which happens every year in early November. But yes, it's really nice to have some great news finally.
It sure is, although, of course, it's not great news for every European. I imagine one Boris Johnson is a little bit nervous about what's going to happen geopolitically.
And the civilian prime minister is not very happy to see his friend Trumpy go away.
Did you see that article in the Sunday Times from Tim Shipman talking about what this means for Boris Johnson, what Biden's win means?
Oh.
It included some pretty good, like, anonymous sourcing from Democratic insiders saying things like, if you think Joe hates him, you should hear Kamala. And yeah, people within Biden's team apparently just think he is racist.
Wow, well, this is going to be a fun 4 years then, isn't it?
We'll see what happens.
There was a lot of chat on the internet this week about, like, why Europeans have followed the US election quite so obsessively when we don't really show the same enthusiasm for our own election coverage, which is something that I think we would like to come back and talk about at some point. But for now, we're really delighted to be finally thinking about other things and talking about other things. And what are we talking about this week?
Well, this weekend, Berlin's elderly Tegel Airport waved off its final flight. And the airport was able to close because in the past few weeks, Berlin has opened a brand spanking new airport, Berlin Brandenburg Airport, aka BER. Maybe brand spanking new is a bit misleading, though, because planning on this airport began soon after the Berlin Wall fell. Yes, in the late 80s. The building of this airport has become a saga worthy of an entire podcast series. And today, our guest is one of the makers of such a podcast series called How to Fuck Up an Airport. It's a series that explores what the fuck went wrong and why this airport has taken so long to open. We promise it will be equal parts entertaining and depressing.
Yay! But first...
Who's had a good week, Katie?
Well, I want to give an honorary mention to the German-Turkish couple behind the company that worked with Pfizer on the coronavirus vaccine. Looks like it's been a very good week for you, although it's still a story that's developing at the time of recording.
And they're a really nice story of second-generation immigrants from Turkey moving to Europe and, oh God, I'm making it sound like the American dream. The European dream!
I'm claiming this as a victory for all children of immigrants, including myself. So well done, vaccine couple. This is one for all of us. But I'm not actually giving good week to them. I'm giving it to that sexiest of EU topics, the rule of law. You said something that confused me the other day, Dominic. You said you thought I was the resident rule of law expert on this podcast. And I have to confess, I don't think that's backed by any evidence.
Well, except that I think you use the term rule of law more than anyone I know.
I think I just feel really strongly about it because it's one of those things that's really important. But people in the Brussels bubble often talk about the rule of law like it's a concept that normal Europeans are really familiar with and like talk about in the pub. Which I don't think is the case. But I think it's just a jargon thing. Like, if you ask people, do you think that European countries should be properly functioning democracies? Like, most people would say, yeah, that seems to be a good idea. So sorry if it's patronising and you're all experts on this already. But for those of us who aren't, when we talk about the rule of law, we're talking about things like whether the media are allowed to criticise the government and whether the courts are allowed to work independently of the government and whether citizens get treated equally and whether people get away with corruption or not. It is all of those things that together form a picture of whether our institutions are actually functioning properly or not.
Quite important things.
Very important things. So with all of that said, the reason it's been a good week for the rule of law is that there's been a deal reached to create a link between receiving EU money and respecting the rule of law. So if you are a naughty government that chips away at your national democracy or says horrible things about minorities or if officials are getting away with corruption, you might get your money taken away.
Something that a lot of people have been pushing for a very long time.
Yeah, it came up a lot over the summer. If you cast your mind back to those, what feels like years ago, but it was just a few months ago, when all of our governments got together to negotiate a new budget for the next 7 years. And also a massive financial rescue package because of the C word, the pandemic. And over the summer and since then, a lot of Western European governments like Finland and the Netherlands have been really pushing for EU money to come with strings attached. It's also something, by the way, that ordinary European taxpayers really want. There was a survey done and 77% of Europeans believe that receiving EU cash should be dependent on governments behaving properly.
Is this policy targeted at a couple of very specific governments?
Yeah, there might be a bit of an elephant in the room here. Can you guess who the two current biggest recipients of EU money are?
Hungary and Romania?
It's actually Hungary and Poland. Those two get back a whole lot more cash from the EU than they put in. In Poland's case, it's more than 11 billion euros. Hungary gets back about 5 billion per year. And these, of course, are the two governments, more than any other, that have been scandalising the rest of Europe with just how undemocratic and authoritarian they've become. They're not alone, I should add. A bunch of different governments have faced criticism recently for not being as squeaky clean as they should be. But Hungary and Poland have definitely both come under a lot of criticism. In Hungary, you've got this media landscape that is incredibly dominated by government propaganda, and it's really, really hard for independent media to operate. In Poland, you've got a situation where the government has been basically dismantling the independent court system. Just this year, they passed new legislation that means that politicians can fire judges that they don't like. It's really disturbing. And until now, there hasn't really been that much that the rest of the EU can do about it.
Isn't Article 7 already there to do this job?
Yeah, so both Hungary and Poland have had this thing called Article 7 proceedings initiated against them. Very exciting. So that is a process that could, in theory, eventually lead to them having their voting rights removed. Except no one believes that would ever happen because everyone needs to vote unanimously to agree on that. And Poland and Hungary would just step in and protect each other.
Okay, so is this new taking their money away thing more likely to actually work?
Well, that is the big question. Maybe. The good thing right now is that, in theory, to take away funding from a naughty government, you wouldn't need the other governments to be unanimous about it. You'd only need a qualified majority of countries, which is 55% of countries representing 65% of the overall EU population. Are you still following?
Yes, I am. And that's something that Ursula von der Leyen is like generally keen on, isn't it? She mentioned it in her State of the Union.
You're such a nerd for knowing that. But that's one of the good bits. The other thing is that they've been quite fair in the way that it works, this new mechanism. So if you are, for example, a Polish farmer who was supposed to get some money via your government, and then your government or the local authority gets cut off because they've done something terrible, you will still be allowed to apply for your individual bit of money via a website. Apparently. The bad bit is that we're still negotiating the overall 7-year budget for the EU, and Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is now threatening, surprise, surprise, to veto the budget because of this rule of law thing. There's actually been some debate about whether Hungary or Poland would follow through and torpedo the budget over this thing. Some people suggest that they don't really want to do that because they really need the money that is due to start coming in January, so delaying it isn't really in their interests. And a lot of people are also saying that in practical terms, this new rule of law thing, it might not end up being that much stronger than the previous things we've tried to do to get governments to behave. There is a lot that is still unclear now, but I do think it's a step in the right direction, so it still qualifies as Good Week.
Great.
Who's had a bad week?
Well, this week I have a story that could have been in Good Week if we'd covered it last week, because I was pretty impressed last week when I read that the Danish government had proposed an initiative to impose 2 meat-free days each week in all state canteens. So state canteens include canteens at army barracks, police stations and all other government buildings, but not including schools. These canteens together provide 800,000 meals a day, so that would be a significant amount of meat-free meals made. And it also has a powerful symbolism that could maybe make people think about the damage of mass animal farming and realise that some meals without meat are actually quite tasty. And of course, it would help in the progress towards Denmark meeting their pretty ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets. They're aiming for a cut of 70% by 2030. Higher than a lot of other countries.
Mm.
Changing our diets, at least to some extent, is probably going to be necessary if we want to keep this planet we live on habitable. So the idea was 2 days a week with no meat at all, plus beef or lamb would be served at maximum once a week. And for this, we could have easily given Denmark Good Week last week. But sadly for Denmark, as they say on the Great British Bake Off, this week I've got the horrible job of announcing who's getting bad week. And bad week indeed goes to Denmark, because mere days after this new policy was announced, with splashy coverage in big international outlets, they had to U-turn on the policy.
Presumably there's been a massive backlash then. Who's angry about it?
Yeah, the trade unions were not happy at all with this policy, and they don't want their workers to be forced to have meat-free days. Not everything is lost, according to the government's climate spokesperson. She says that they've come up with a pragmatic compromise and there's now going to be a voluntary meat-free initiative.
Oh, I see. Like canteen by canteen.
Yeah. Not really the same, though, is it?
I have to confess, I didn't realise it was only 2 days a week that we're being asked to do this. It doesn't seem that totalitarian and fascistic to ask people to do it for 2 days a week.
No, and when you think about it, people probably have usually one of their meals a day at their work canteen, and they can always bring in their own meat if they're so desperate to have meat every day.
Yeah, bring yourself a ham sandwich.
Exactly. I should also point out that scientists said that this policy was unlikely to make much difference to greenhouse gas emissions, because Denmark is such a huge exporter of meat and actually the biggest producer of meat per capita in the world.
Danish bacon.
Exactly. I just watched that episode of Borgen that's all about Danish pigs.
Oh, I haven't seen that one, or at least I don't remember it.
I didn't remember either. I'm watching for a second time. It's in season 3 and yeah, it's not a very good episode, actually, to be honest.
No.
But the vast majority of the meat produced in Denmark is exported. So a cut in domestic meat consumption, even a considerable one, wouldn't make such a big difference to greenhouse gas levels in the country.
No.
And Greenpeace Denmark think that regardless of this policy with the state canteens, meat production in Denmark needs to shrink. There are 2.15 pigs in Denmark for every human being.
Wow.
And Greenpeace claim that 28% of Denmark's greenhouse gases come from meat and dairy production, which is a pretty huge number. But the climate spokesman of the ruling Social Democrats said that there was no plan to reduce livestock capacity in Denmark, saying that Denmark has one of the most climate-efficient livestock sectors. So there's clearly some disagreement there. But for getting us all excited about a meat-free policy and then rowing it back, you get bad week, Denmark.
We have four amazing new supporters to thank this week. Big thanks go to Catherine Spinks, Manuel García Escobar, Ivana Novak and Matty Allam. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, they've all signed up to throw a handful of euros a month our way to help us keep running this independent podcast. Our podcast is and will remain free to listen to, but if you want to help us out, then we'd be ever so grateful. Head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Or if you want to give us a one-off donation, that's also appreciated. Head to europeanspodcast.com/support-us. Thank you, wonderful Patreons.
After quite a stressful week for much of the world, we wanted to bring you a fun interview this week. You might have seen headlines about the long-awaited opening of Berlin's new airport, Brandenburg Airport, or BER, as we're calling it after its international code. That might sound like a really boring, prosaic news story, the opening of an airport, but it is anything but. The story of Berlin's new airport is so chaotic, it has taken decades to get this place open. And it is a story of corruption. It is a story of incompetence. It's honestly super fun to hear about, even if it is really scandalous that so much public money has been poured into this hot mess of an airport. And we've invited the perfect person to talk about it, Joran Mandic. He is one of the co-hosts of the podcast How to Fuck Up an Airport, a series from the Berlin radio show Radio Spetkauf. And the series examines in depth what the hell went wrong here. Joran joined us, of course, from Berlin.
Berlin-Brandenburg Airport. It is finally open. And there's a lot to say about this mess up of an airport. But I was wondering if you could start by giving us like a bit of background about the basic facts. How long has this taken? How much is it over budget? How much of a disaster is it?
It is a huge disaster, I would say. In our podcast series, we go back to before the wall even came down. This is how long this thing has been in the making. It starts really with people thinking about Berlin needs a new international airport as a sort of hub of the middle of Europe pre the wall coming down. So in the 80s at some point, there was extensive research on a possible site to put the airport on. And then finally, after, I guess, 20 years of people thinking about it, they started constructing this airport in Schönefeld. So that's where there's already a smaller airport that's currently still running. And they decided to put the new airport sort of right next to it, or a few kilometers south of it. So in 2006, they started doing this, and it's taken them till 2020 to complete it.
Why, in a nutshell?
We have made 5 episodes going into why, so there's a lot of reasons. But I think, in a nutshell, you'd say it's a combination of hubris, stupidity, incompetency, corruption, and maybe a little bit of bad luck.
Wow, a toxic combination. Could you give us an example of like one of the shocking mistakes that's been made?
I mean, one really funny one that we all like. This is a small one only, though. But at one point, they put in escalators that were just too short. And so at the end of the escalator, they put in 2 steps so that people would have to walk 2 steps after taking up the elevators. It's a beautiful picture of how wrong things went, I think. An early big fuck up was the choice of location. They had 7 locations that they could choose between, and they chose really the worst one, Schönefeld, instead of, for example, Sperenberg, which is in the open forest and you'd have nothing to worry about. In Schönefeld, you have a lot of neighbors. They had to relocate an entire village, which cost 80 million euros. 10% of the entire budget is spent on soundproofing homes near this new airport. Another good one is that I think their motivation was to keep jobs in Berlin as much as possible. So they opted to start a airport company themselves, or the airport company that existed. They expanded a little bit and tried to build this airport by themselves without any previous construction experience whatsoever, instead of getting a big company that knows how to do big projects. And then they subcontracted a lot of different small parcels of work to different small companies because they wanted small companies from Berlin and Brandenburg to be able to take on these jobs. So that's where I think hubris played a big role, because it went horribly wrong. It got so expensive.
One of the things that I've really enjoyed hearing about in your podcast is the various things that they had to do and spend money on after the building was basically finished, completed, but then didn't open for almost 10 years. Could you tell us about like one of those things?
Well, at one point, politicians decided or realized that the capacity was too small. And so they basically said, all right, let's double the size, even though most of the base construction was already done. And also the entire airport was designed without shops in mind, basically, because the architect behind it, Meinhard von Gerkan, he wrote this whole book about how much he hates the mollification of airports. So he didn't plan for any shops. But Berlin-Brandenburg, they realized, oh, we maybe need to make a little bit of money putting in some shops. And so then they had to retrofit hundreds of shops into this airport building and basically start all over again. Another thing was the fire safety system that was completely bungled up. They had put like squeezing lots of cables into small spaces. So that's a big fire hazard. They didn't put in any lightning rods at first. They were retrofitted. These things all contributed to, in 2012, finally, with only a few weeks to go to opening, one bureaucrat didn't approve the plans for opening and said, this is not safe. That was the first major delay in 2012.
Because of this whole fire mess up, wasn't there some insane plan at some point for humans, like 800 humans, yeah, to work as fire alarms, yes, and just like shout fire if they saw a fire?
Yeah, they were going to hire up to 800 people to use as a human machine interface and literally stand there and look for fire because the smoke ventilation system, the sprinklers, they didn't work properly. Yeah, it was an absolute mess.
But they fixed it, and 8 years later, the airport is finally open. And you actually got to go and have a look around it, I believe, recently on a like testing day. What did you think? Is it worth the wait?
I mean, they started building this in 2006, and it was designed even longer ago. And it sort of does have that feel. Like, my personal takeaway from a visit there was, like, it's not quite finished. When we were walking around, there was still people angle grinding. There were literal sparks flying. There were construction fences and cardboard on the floor all through the duty-free area. It didn't look finished. And yet, it already looked a little bit dated, you know, which is a bit of a bummer. And then design-wise, it's very restrained and one might say boring. You know, it's very straight lines, 90-degree angles. There's not really ever a point where you're surprised to find a new area or a little nap site or anything like that.
And one of the things I really liked that you mentioned in the podcast was that there's not that many charging points because this airport is like a relic from the mid-noughties. So people weren't as dependent on their devices as they are now, perhaps.
Yeah, I can't say for sure, like I'm speculating there, but in 2006, not everybody had an iPhone, this is true, and it wasn't as ubiquitous, and there are no outlets in the walls anywhere. But we found out on the day that we were there that they are planning to put in charging stations, they call them.
Yay!
So I guess they would have a few little pylons around with USB outlets, you know?
So it's kind of hilarious how much of a mess it is. And yeah, I like that about your podcast, that you see the funny side of it. But it's also kind of serious how much money has been wasted. And the corruption is also pretty serious. Have any of the people who have messed this up got into trouble yet? Will there be any repercussions?
No. I mean, we've gone through a few CEOs. The first one who was responsible for most of the fuck-ups that we go through in the show, his name was Rainer Schwarz. He got fired, but the paperwork on that was bungled up. So he sued and won a 1 million euro payout. And we tried to get him for an interview when we recorded a few years ago, the first few episodes, and he never got back to us. So he's moved on. He's now with Ryanair.
Makes sense.
So I don't think he has to fear any repercussions. And I don't think anybody else really either. The people that will feel it are the taxpayers. And this is what we go into in our latest episode, is what happens now with flights being down 70% roughly in Berlin due to the pandemic. The airport is heading for real financial trouble. Also, we go into a few, they've done a bit of dodgy accounting where they don't account for all their debts properly. And spoke to some experts that think that perhaps in a few years BER will be bankrupt. And to stay afloat now during the pandemic, they already need more money injected into it.
Yeah, it's very much not the end of the saga. I thought it was really interesting in your latest episode how you talked about how the pandemic has in some ways, well, yeah, it could be a potential source of disaster for the airport. But in another way, it's also kind of saved it because it's got really limited capacity, this airport, right? So the fact that people aren't flying in and out has sort of in the short term, like, saved face, I guess.
I guess it does afford them a bit of a soft start to try things out. The airport company does claim that they have sufficient capacity. Some people have doubts about this. Surely if Berlin's travel numbers grow as they were projected pre-pandemic, it will soon be too small and they will have to try to expand. But I just wanted to give you the numbers on the costs and how they've spiraled. So the first budget that the plans were approved with was 630 million euros. And by the time construction started, it was already at 2 billion. And today, I just said, the total known costs are 6.5 billion euros. So that's 10 times, more than 10 times more than what they had initially planned for, which is huge. And we don't actually know if that's all that there is or what the money has even spent on, because it is run as a private company. It's owned by the public, but it's run as a private company. And so it's under no obligation to reveal anything more than its headline numbers. And even those are potentially unreliable. So we don't really know if 6.5 billion euros is the total sum of it.
One of the things I found really interesting about this story is that the opening of the airport, it does mean that one of Berlin's other airports, Tegel, is closing. And quite a lot of Berliners seem like weirdly emotionally attached to this airport. Like, can you explain why the old airport occupies this special spot in the city psyche?
It's a really cute airport. It's designed as a hexagon. So you walk around this donut between gates, which is very unique. Everyone has fond memories of flying into holidays out of Tegel. It's just, it was a nice airport for sure. I personally don't feel super nostalgic for it.
Neither do I.
But a lot of people do, yes.
Foreigners tend to think of Germany as like an efficient country where everything works. And I'm definitely guilty myself of indulging in the stereotype and thinking like, wow, things are just like better run in Germany. I don't want to like force you into being unpatriotic, but do you think the airport should be used as an example internationally of like, hey, this isn't a perfect country where everything just works?
I think BR is doing a great job of putting an end to that terrible stereotype about Germans. Actually, Joel, who wrote and produced most of this podcast, his personal thesis is that the entire BR thing, the biggest problem of all was the unfailing belief in German efficiency. This is how he puts it. So yeah, I think you've got a point there for sure.
So if that's tickled your fancy, then head over to your podcast feed and subscribe to How to Fuck Up an Airport. They just recently released an update episode after the airport opened. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we didn't talk about. It's weirder than you could ever imagine.
Thank you very much to the numerous listeners who've suggested over, I think, a couple of years now that we talk about this airport on the podcast, particularly Madara Bryce, who suggested it recently. We really love getting ideas for what to talk about on the show. So hit us up. hello@europeanspodcast.com. Isolation inspiration time. What have you been watching or reading or otherwise consuming this week, Dominic?
Well, I think as we alluded to at the beginning of the show, I basically haven't been consuming anything other than the American election this week. My pretty unhealthy addiction. Yeah, I fell off the wagon. So I'm going to break the rules a little bit this week and give you a recommendation from an American podcast. But it's a very European and calming interview in an American podcast. I wanted to recommend the interview with Belgian superstar psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Oh, yeah.
She was interviewed by Kara Swisher on the relatively new New York Times interview podcast called Sway, which I've been enjoying. And Esther gives amazing advice on what to do if you have family members with conflicting political views, a problem that's particularly stark in America, I think, but also I'm sure a lot of our European listeners have that in their own family situations.
Because we are Homo sapiens, we really think that you resolve something by digging further into the topic. when in fact, if we were animals, we would just be doing faces right now and sounds. And when you see that the sounds don't make sense and don't accomplish anything, you have got to go around to the feelings, to the emotional connection that you have with her. You know, I know that it would devastate you if any of us were ever sick. I know that you are that kind of a mother.
She also talks about the strain on relationships that this pandemic and particularly that lockdowns have put on us and how touch-starved some people are right now.
Yeah, I really want to hug people.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? But she speaks about it so eloquently and I found it really inspiring and calming. So yeah, it's an American podcast and I know many of you come here specifically to avoid this kind of recommendation. But I think this episode from a Belgian psychotherapist of Polish Jewish descent feels European enough for me just to get away with it. What about you, Katie?
I've also been really naughty this week.
Oh no.
Well, there's a couple of things coming out next week that I really want to talk about, but they're not out yet, so I can't. So I'm afraid, like you, I've also been mostly watching TV news this week and there hasn't been a lot of time for culture. And I have to confess that the main show I've been watching has also not been European. I have been watching Queen's Gambit on Netflix, which, as you probably know by now, is excellent because everybody is watching it. But again, I think I can just about justify it as a European recommendation because, did you know that even though it is set in Kentucky, it was filmed in Berlin?
No way. Why?
That's a good question. I don't actually know. I will look into that and get back to you. But how's this for a theme, this episode? It was actually filmed next to the new airport.
Really? Oh, okay. You get away with it then.
Haha. I actually learned that courtesy of a great Twitter thread from our former guest, Deborah Cole, which I posted on our Twitter, but I will repost it in the show notes. She talks about the Jewish history of the main building where it's set, which is absolutely fascinating.
I wonder whether Netflix did this to meet their requirements to produce a certain amount of European content each year.
Ah, well, then it would definitely qualify as a European recommendation and I'd be in the clear.
I'm skeptical. So a couple were walking in northern France when they found a tiny aluminium capsule lying in a field. A small rusty object that you could easily miss, but they noticed it and picked it up. Looking more closely, they discovered that it contained some rolled up paper with barely legible writing on it. The couple did the very sensible thing and decided to take it to the nearest museum at Orbey, which happens to be dedicated to the First World War. And that was a happy decision because it seems that this capsule is a relic of exactly that era. They think this little piece of aluminium had been attached to the foot of a little carrier pigeon.
Cute.
Probably during the First World War. The letter details military manoeuvres and seems to be from a junior soldier passing on news to a superior. Of course, the sad news for this Prussian soldier who sent this message is that it never got to his boss. And I have to say, it does make me lean into my suspicions that carrier pigeons weren't the most foolproof method of transport. I'm happy we have email these days. But it is extraordinary to think that people actually used carrier pigeons as an effective method of passing messages, or not so effective in this case. It still blows my mind. And you know me, I love a discovery of something ancient being discovered in somewhere unexpected. Unlike some of my other stories from this genre of happy ending, this story doesn't end with a big cash bounty for the finders. They seem to have donated it voluntarily to the local museum, who were checking it over, and it will now be on display for all to see. That maybe makes it even more of a happy ending for all of us than if they'd made loads of money out of selling it.
Weirdly, I've got quite obsessed with French carrier pigeons recently.
Really?
I know that's really specific, but I was reading about the Franco-Prussian War and the role of pigeons in that, which was absolutely crazy. They had this like army, the French had this like army of pigeons, and the messages were like shrunk really, really tiny. They used this like micro photography technology to make these like tiny, tiny little messages so that the pigeons could carry loads and loads of information, which isn't even the best bit of the story. So the Prussians, to fight these carrier pigeons, had like a a fleet of falcons to try and attack the pigeons.
No way. Maybe that's what happened here, even though it's a different war.
What, that it was taken down by an enemy falcon?
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly the pigeon didn't make it.
Sad.
It is sad, but it's also amazing.
Before we go, I actually wanted to give a heads up that I am speaking at a Bulgarian podcasting festival next week, which is very exciting.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and they've got some really big names, much bigger than me, I should say, including Latif Nasser from Radiolab. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you're interested in podcasting in general, you might want to grab yourself a ticket. You don't need to be in Bulgaria. It's all happening on the internet because of you know what. So I'll post the link to that in the show notes.
We'll be back next week as normal on Wednesday, hopefully still feeling this light, happy feeling.
Probably not. It's 2020. Something terrible will happen in between.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the meantime, you can find us on a range of social media platforms, which are Twitter with their @EuropeansPod, Instagram @EuropeansPodcast, and if you type in the Europeans Podcast on Facebook, you should find us.
You shall.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Tschüss.